This is Elliot Tiber, the man who saved Woodstock and author of the new book, Taking Woodstock, a new movie by director Ang Lee. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Well, on 21st Century Radio, you have heard us on numerous occasions talking about the Shakespeare authorship question. Now, this is one of those subjects that most readers consider ludicrous at face value. I mean, how could we possibly question that Shakespeare actually wrote Shakespeare? But all you have to do is look at what is behind the question for a few minutes, and the reasonable doubt suddenly becomes glaringly apparent. The more you look at the evidence, and more intriguingly, the lack of evidence, the more the true question becomes, why did someone create the fabrication that the man from Stratford-on-Avon was the author of these great works? This claim that the actor from Stratford was the author of Shakespeare was not made until several years after he died. He never made the claim himself. Did you know that, guys? Well, he was a front. The real question is, who were they shielding and why? In Shakespeare's sonnets, Shakespeare reveals himself as a nobleman. And at least five of Shakespeare's contemporaries also say so in print. William Shakespeare was the great author's pen name, which was also noted by some in the literary world. A hyphen was often put in his surname, which suggested a made-up name of a spear shaker. Our guest for the remainder of tonight is Catherine Children, and she has written an extensive book called Shakespeare Suppressed, The Uncensored Truth About Shakespeare and His Works, Fair Editions 2011, in which she reveals the concept of the Stratford man as Shakespeare is a very old and well-orchestrated fabrication. The makers of this fabrication were Ben Jonson and William Herbert, 3rd Earl of Pembroke. Numerous good books and articles dispelling the case of the Stratford man as the true author and showing that William Shakespeare was someone's pen name have been written. But no matter how compelling the evidence and the arguments, the ivory-towered professors of Shakespearean literature will not entertain even a shred of doubt about their alleged Stratfordian Shakespeare. Why does this tiny elite minority continue to control an erroneous Shakespeare opinion? Well, I'll give you a hint. It has to do with money. Let's find out what Catherine Children has to say. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Catherine.
Thank you, Dr. Bob. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm so glad you're here, too, and I'm so glad you put this book together. Now, we all read a few Shakespeare plays in high school, Catherine. You are saying that we are exposed to an educational conspiracy. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Actually, it's a lie, the idea that the Stratford man was the great author, because no lifetime evidence supports it. We have contemporary evidence showing that the Stratford man was involved in the theater, and that he was possibly an actor, but acting is not writing. And theater investing, which for sure he was, that also is not writing. So what we need is some contemporary evidence by these elites in their ivory towers to prove that the Stratford man was a great author. They constantly rely on posthumous evidence. And, you know, which is more important, lifetime or posthumous? I think we should look at the lifetime evidence.
Well, yeah, obviously.
And if we look at what contemporaries were actually saying in print about the great author, they're different from the posthumous accounts.
Yeah, we'll certainly get to that. I remember some of the details about Shakespeare's bio, like he was born in Henley Street, and his dad was a glove maker, etc. What else do we know there?
We know that he was christened. We know that he was married, and that his children were christened. And we know that he bought property And we know that he owed taxes, and we know that he tried to sue a few people to get back some loans. But we don't have anything related to education or writing. And those are the two most important things when we're talking about Shakespeare.
Well, yeah, that's what shocked me so much. This, about 45 years ago, I mean, I could not believe what I was seeing when I started researching in this area. Six signatures that don't necessarily look like one another, and sometimes spelled a little bit differently, and that's it. That's all
right.
Of his writing we have. Whoop, I didn't mean to jump ahead there.
but you're right.
But it was shocking. It was shocking. And, of course, I asked a lot of people about that, and it said, why? What do you mean? Come on now. We got all his plays. But we don't have anything. And what really, really surprised me more than anything, Catherine, was when I read his will. When I read his will, I couldn't believe that it's been accepted. Would you want to tell us a little bit about his will?
Yes, his will has absolutely nothing literary about it. He didn't write it, number one. It was a very a legal document. There is no references to books at all, and yet several of his plays were printed in his lifetime, as well as Venus and Adonis, which was a very popular poem, a long narrative poem that was printed, went through several editions. There's no accounting of that book. There's no theater shares, and although it's on record that he did buy theater shares, they are not listed in his will. But most importantly, you were mentioning about no manuscripts. There were several, at the time of his death, there were several Shakespeare plays that had not been printed yet, about 20. And there is no accounting of what should happen to those unpublished manuscripts, which is very unusual. For example, the Strafford man's son-in-law was a doctor, a physician, and he kept some extensive medical case books. And he made arrangements, at his death that, what to do with those manuscripts. I mean, he cared about those manuscripts. I mean, they were not works of, literature. They were just basically his notes, but even he thought that those were important. So it just doesn't add up, the Strafford man's will, among many other things.
Well, he didn't own very much. He didn't, since I would have thought that in his will, Catherine, that it would mention where his books were. He would have had some pens, and he would have had some paper. I understand that his wife got his second best bed, but I would have thought that there would have been a good deal more involved in a will like that. I don't know how any professor or scholar can look at that and say, well, we have a real educated individual here. When you read his stuff, he sure is all get out. Is extraordinary. Different languages, different places, world traveler. None of this is connected to the person that we now call Shakespeare. But tell us what you mean by you talked a little bit about the educational problem when it comes to the great author versus Strafford. What about kind of vocabulary? About that area, please.
Well, we have no evidence of schooling for Shakespeare. We don't have it for sure for the Strafford man because the local grammar school, those records do not survive during that exact period. So we can't say it one way or the other. But whoever the great author was, he had an exceptional education. He knew about rhetoric. He knew about medicine. There's over 600 references to medicine. He knew about the law. He knew about European geography. He knew ancient Greek and rhetoric. And these topics are only taught either at the university or, in the case of law, there were law schools. And we have all of those records. We have law school records that have survived during that period. We have university records that survived, and there's no William Shakespeare. There's no William Shakespeare connected to a scholarship. Some of the schools in London would offer scholarships. No William Shakespeare. There is no, like, if the Strapper Man were the great author, certainly someone would have noted it. His parents would maybe take him to a vicar or some educated person and say, look at this, you know, child prodigy. He's wonderful. But we don't have that. It's a big zero. And when you look at all the great topics that Shakespeare was aware of, it's just there's no accounting for it. And the professor will tell you, oh, well, he learned French. He picked it up at the Mermaid Tavern. I mean, they just throw out a speculation, you know, to try and account for his work, this knowledge, and there's nothing.
Well, we've already touched on the manuscripts problem, but friends, think about that. Here you have, if this man, Shakespeare, really wrote those plays, there have to be a manuscript somewhere. There has to. This is just amazing that it can be rationalized. That's a lot of rationalization on a professor's part, you know, speculation. But it's not necessarily, it can't be proven.
Yeah, we have letters surviving for almost all of the major writers of the period have left behind letters. And even Ben Jonson, who was, you know, very highly regarded back then, we have an entire manuscript of one of his masks, which was a form of a play, in his handwriting. So it doesn't make sense. We have a manuscript of Edward Allen, who was a huge actor back then, and one of the plays of Robert Greene. He possessed the manuscript. And he wrote his own personal annotations of that. That survives. How come we don't have something like that for Shakespeare?
Well, certainly he had contemporaries, and I'm sure those contemporaries are going to come up and say, well, I knew the man. What can you tell us about all of his contemporaries in regards to this?
Well, that's it. There is no personal accounts of Shakespeare during his lifetime. But there were some of his contemporaries who made these little clues about him. They were not directly, they were not open, but if you analyze these comments, you get a whole different picture of Shakespeare. And they basically point to him being a man who was of high rank, like a nobleman, that he was not a professional writer, that he was actually writing as a hobby. Yes, and they also implied that the name was a pen name, William Shakespeare. Or that he was writing anonymously. They wrote that he didn't want to be praised because it could stain his name. That's another indication of nobility. They were saying that he was writing plays at least 20 or 30 years earlier than what the Shakespeare professor will tell you today. So all these things, including him being dead by the year 1607, and the Strapper Man died in 1616.
Well, that doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't add up to what we know about the Strapper Man. It paints an entirely different picture.
Well,
that's the evidence that we should be looking at, not the posthumous evidence, which I believe was a hoax.
You know, there was more evidence of weapons and mass destruction and the we went through with the former Republican administration. There was more evidence, and there wasn't any. I mean, but
exactly.
I mean, we were railroaded then by Mr. Dick Cheney, who would love to be president. Well, he was president. He was our president of the United States for at least 4 years there. When you take a look at the past and you see a manuscripts problem, a theater problem, a lack of his contemporaries talking about him, his dying in 1607, and of course he's still writing into 9 years later. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But it seems that the professors, they're smarter than we are, Catherine. They are much smarter than we are, and we'll figure out how in the world he did it not knowing anything. All right, welcome back with our guest, Catherine Chilton. Shakespeare Suppressed, the uncensored truth about Shakespeare and his works. Fair editions, shakespearesuppressed.com. You might also like checking out the luminaries who have signed the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt at www.doubtaboutwill.org. I'll have to do that again. www.doubtaboutwill.org. This site also discusses the large reward they have offered to the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust for proof that the Stratford man was really the great author. So far, the trust has only ignored that offer.
I'm Joe Sobrin, author of Alias Shakespeare. You're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
Oh, boy, we had a great time with Joe. I'm sorry. Well, he's passed on to the spirit world, and he's probably a hell of a lot happier now than he ever was. But sure do miss him. Our guest is Catherine Chilgen. Shakespeare Suppressed, the uncensored truth about Shakespeare and his works. Fair editions, shakespearesuppressed.com. Well, what did contemporaries think of Shakespeare, and how do you back that up?
Well, in what sense? Like who he was? Or, I mean, he was...
Yes, who...
I mean, his works were extremely popular during his lifetime. And we know that because the plays were printed. Many, many of... 16 plays were printed during his lifetime. And two poems, Venus and Adonis and the Rape of Lucrece, as soon as they were published, they were immediately imitated by other writers. So he was really a leader. And that's kind of contra to what the professor will tell you. He will tell you that Shakespeare was almost a plagiarist, that he was borrowing from other works. It's really the other way around. They've got that part wrong.
Well, didn't some of them believe he was a nobleman using the pen name?
Yes, I believe he was a nobleman. He was the 17th Earl of Oxford, who also Joe Sobrin believed as well. Oxford, my book is mostly about the Stratford man, but you just need to look very briefly at the Earl of Oxford's life, and you can see he was supremely qualified to be the great author. I mean, he went to Cambridge University when he was 8 years old. And then he went on to Oxford University, so he got his master's. From there, he went to law school, and after law school, he was married, and a few years later, he took a grand tour of Europe. He was deeply involved in literature. He was a great patron of histories and literature, and you can go on and on. There's so many parallels between his life and the plays.
And the plays.
Yes, I think he was definitely the one behind the pen name. And you have to keep in mind that during this period, noblemen who were involved in literature or the theater, that was considered frivolous. So it was not something that you wanted to advertise to your people of the same social level. Mm-hmm. And so, see, he purposely suppressed it during his lifetime. But the problem was, after his death, he should have gotten credit.
Well, certainly. Well, I'm biased now because why didn't he get any credit?
Well, that really is the true question, and that's what I try to get into in Shakespeare's Oppressed. I have two chapters that go into depth. I think it was a political cover-up because of Shakespeare's sonnets. The sonnets, which were Shakespeare's personal ruminations, talk about a young man, the young fair youth, in royal terms. And it seems to be that Shakespeare believed that this young man was a prince, was the queen's child. You really have to look at the imagery. It's not said directly. And the Queen Elizabeth's successor was King James. So once this the sonnets were printed, I believe it created a crisis, a political crisis, because they did not want the world to know that the writer of Shakespeare was a nobleman who would know what was going on at the court. Mm-hmm. And if they put the authorship on the Stratford man, that would divert the attention away. The Stratford man had no court connections at all. He would not know anything about hidden royal children. And I think that's, in essence, what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Michael Drayton here. He was an English poet who came to prominence in the Elizabethan era. He was a contemporary and connected to Stratford. What do we learn from his record?
Did you say Michael Drayton?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Sorry.
Yes, he was the same, lived in the same county as the Stratford man. He lived about the same time frame. He was a playwright and a poet. There's no recollections of him, you know, knowing Shakespeare. He made one remark about being Shakespeare's master, but that was decades after Drayton had died, so we don't even know 100% if that's a true statement. Also, very interesting is that the Stratford man, his son-in-law, I mentioned, was a physician, and he treated Michael Drayton. He lived just not too far away from Stratford-upon-Avon, where he was practicing, and he made a notation that Michael Drayton was an excellent poet. But this son-in-law of the great author supposedly made no mention that he was connected to Shakespeare.
Yeah, you would have thought.
It's another big zero.
I'm sorry. It's really not a laughing matter, but it is in a certain sense. The foolishness of this particular situation. What did contemporary artists say about his passing?
Yeah, that's another wonderful big zero. Whenever the great author died, no one noted it. Certainly when the Stratford man died in 1616, no notice. And yet you have, in the same year, another playwright died, just a couple months before the Stratford man. And everybody, notice was taken, you know, and also he was buried in Westminster Abbey. And the same was true for Edmund Spenser, who died in 1599. There was great acclaim at his death, eulogies, and he was buried in Westminster Abbey. And yet Shakespeare, who was probably more popular than both of them combined, no one said a word. I think that, again, is another indication of a political issue surrounding Shakespeare.
Well, I agree, because he was so popular to actually not be able, well, to be able to say we didn't know him is ridiculous. And of course, our artists saying, they don't say anything about one of the most popular of the writers when they're going to talk about other writers that don't have half that ability. It is really puzzling, but it's not so puzzling if this was almost like we were being led to keep our eyes closed in this particular area. Now, with all this evidence pointing against the Stratford man, why does everyone believe that the Stratford man was the great author?
Well, and that's the posthumous evidence, and that occurred 7 years after the Stratford man died, in the form of a book, a collection of Shakespeare plays, 36 Shakespeare plays. It was a very large book in folio page sizes, so they call it the first folio, 1623. And it was in the opening pages of this book that, for the very first time, the term Avon and the term Stratford became associated with the great author. Now remember, this is 7 years after the Stratford man had died. Mm-hmm. And this is the source of it. So you have Ben Jonson saying in an elegy to Shakespeare, calling him Sweet Swan of Avon, and then a few pages later, another poet referring to Shakespeare and his Stratford monument. And there is a monument in Stratford-upon-Avon. And it clicked. Even though that phrase, Stratford-upon-Avon, is nowhere in those opening pages, neither is there any biographical material about the great author. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly no coat of arms of the Stratford men. And
we
keep in mind that these opening 16 pages, preliminary pages, that five of them were blank. So there was plenty of room to give us an idea of something about Shakespeare's life.
But right now we've run out of room in this hour, and we'll have to continue into next hour with Catherine Chilton, Shakespeare Suppressed, The Uncensored Truth About Shakespeare and His Works. Fair Editions, ShakespeareSuppressed.com.
Simulating talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Jane Metzler calling the
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm the alleged Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner. Our engineer is Noah Dankner, who broke the record. He broke the record. 250 one-hand push-ups within 10 minutes. My God, that's amazing. And our guest is Catherine Chilton, an independent scholar who has studied the Shakespeare authorship question for over 26 years. She has debated the topic with English professors at the Smithsonian Institution and at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco. I love San Francisco. She has written several articles for the newsletter of the Shakespeare Oxford Society, was its editor, and is a former society trustee. Graduate of UCLA, and of course, if I'm Chinese, I'm supposed to say UCRA, a BA history and history. Chilton has been an Oxfordian since early 1985, with Carlton Ogburn, appeared in a TV debate with a Shakespeare professor on the firing line. Chilton has published two anthologies, Dedication Letters to the Earl of Oxford and Letters and Poems of Edward Earl of Oxford, 1998. In April 2012, Chilton received an award for distinguished scholarship at Concordia University, Portland, Oregon, for Shakespeare Suppressed, The Uncensored Truth About Shakespeare and His Works, published by Fair Editions in 2011. And this is the book that we're going to be talking about the rest of the night. And I got to make a comment here about Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney had one of the worst health situations, period. And yet he still became president of the United States under W. So what does that mean when he questions somebody else's health? Even if you had poor health like he did, you can still be a president, but he made a lot of mistakes, as we all know today. Okay, Catherine, let's see. What we were talking about, the first folio and monument, and we didn't finish that particular topic, did we?
Well, I have more to talk about it.
I'd like to hear more on that, please.
Yeah, well, you know, the opening pages of this book are very odd, and it gives all the signs of a hoax. And it starts with that well-known picture today, black and white engraving by Droeschout of Shakespeare. And the first oddness is that in this picture, there's no indication that he's a writer. There's no pen, paper, there's no book. And there's no laurel leaves. He's not wearing laurel leaves in his hair. And that was a very common way for poets to be depicted back then. Wearing laurel leaves was the sign of poetic victory, you know. So all we have is a man with kind of an oddly shaped forehead and sort of a more pricey collar. I call him a gentleman monster. No one has been very happy with this depiction. So that's kind of the first oddity. But then right opposite this picture, this well-known picture, is a verse by Ben Jonson. And he, in essence, tells the reader, do not look at this picture, look at the book. So, number one, why include the picture at all if we're not supposed to really look at it? Number two, I think it could be that he's telling us to look at the content of the plays, and who the great author is will reveal himself to you. And you know, of course, most of the plays are about high nobility or kings and queens. And I think there was a subtle hint there that he was of the same background. Another sign of the hoax, in my opinion, is that if you turn over the page, there's a dedication letter written to the Earls of Pembroke and Montgomery. They were brother earls. And this dedication letter was signed by two actors of the King's Men Acting Company, the Stratford man was also a member of the King's Men Acting Company. But the interesting thing about this letter is that it was not written by Hemings and Condell. It has been proven, it's been known for over 200 years that actually Ben Jonson wrote this letter. So on each page, you're starting to see some funny business. Mm-hmm. And that's why, when the Shakespeare professor gives this book as really his best evidence, the Stratford man was the great author, and then you see the strangeness, that, you know, you have to question their evidence.
Yes, of course you'd have to. Anyone who is even, you know, this is any type of scholarship would reveal this particular problem. Let's touch a little bit on the plays here. We're just going to touch on a few of them and find out what, if anything, we can learn about the author's biography in them. What do we learn from Romeo and Juliet?
You mean as related to the Earl of Oxford?
Yes.
Like the true author, or?
Well, I think it's necessary to take a look at whether or not they support the possibility of the Earl of Oxford having anything to do with this.
Well, first off, Romeo and Juliet is one of those plays that show a very detailed knowledge of Italy, places in Italy. And I bring up the Shakespeare Guide to Italy, which is a book by Richard Roe that came out just a couple years ago. He gives as his very first example how in Verona there are these sycamore trees just outside of the western wall. Now, this is noted in the very first passage of Romeo and Juliet. It's not important to the plot. It was not noted in the very early sources of Romeo and Juliet, which goes back to the 15th century or 14th century. It's just a minor detail that Shakespeare threw in, which shows you that whoever he was familiar with Italy. Mm-hmm. So that's like one thing you can throw out. As far as related to the Earl of Oxford, he had his own sort of Romeo and Juliet situation where he was in love with a woman named Anne Vavasor, and he was already married at the time. So her family was trying to separate her from him, and there were fights in the streets between her relatives and his subordinates. So that's kind of an interesting parallel right there.
Is this true that Romeo and Juliet is based on a 1562 play?
A poem, yes, by Arthur Brooke. And that's a very interesting piece of evidence to bring up. In my estimation, there are so many verbal parallels between this poem written in 1562. This is 2 years before the Stratford man was alive. Many verbal parallels. And I believe that actually Romeo and Juliet was already a play that was written, and that Arthur Brooke was actually taking choice phrases from it and using it for his poem. And the reason I say that is because in the opening page of Arthur Brooks' poem, he mentions that he had seen the same subject matter of Romeo and Juliet in the theater. Mm-hmm. So, and that he thought that it was much better done than what his poem is. Yeah. So I believe it was written, Romeo and Juliet was probably one of the earliest Shakespeare plays. And of course, the Earl of Oxford at that point was 11 or 12 years old.
My Lord. Whoa. Macbeth. Riverside Shake says Macbeth is yet it is also the most topical of the tragedies, a play shaped as none of the others seems to be by the interests of the reigning monarch. And it was the reign of Queen Elizabeth's successor, James the First. Is this true?
I don't believe so. the professor will tell you it was written for, you know, as a compliment to the new King James in 1605. Mm-hmm. Macbeth is not a very complimentary depiction of the Scots. It was a very bloody play. And there was a play presented at Queen Elizabeth's court like 40 years earlier in the 1560s, right at the time when Mary, Queen of Scots, was involved with the assassination of her husband, Darnley. So, many details in Shakespeare's play echo accounts of the death of Darnley that were not published. So it very well, again, may be another early play in the 1560s. And, of course, when I talk about these early plays, I'm not talking about that Shakespeare wrote the entire play as we now know it. It may have been a very early version, a short version, that later on, over the decades, he improved upon.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. We often hear that Hamlet is considered autobiographical. What's in it that relates to the man from Stratford?
Nothing. Nothing. That's a very good point. The experts always think that Hamlet is the most autobiographical because it's so intensely personal. Mm-hmm. But we don't have anything in the life of the Stratford man that parallels. I mean, that we can say, yeah. They might say that, he named his child Hamnet after Hamlet. Mm-hmm. But that is totally untrue because the Stratford man's son, Hamnet, was named after one of his neighbors. So there really is no connection at all. But if you look at the Earl of Oxford's life, there's many parallels.
There sure are.
Hamlet went to university. Hamlet had a company of players. Hamlet was a Dane. I mean, you can go down the list. I don't have it in front of me. There are all these attributes, you could say, for the Earl of Oxford. And also another interesting thing is that the Earl of Oxford was involved in a piracy. Pirates took over the ship that he was on, and they stripped him to the bone.
Yeah.
And a similar situation happened in Hamlet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, with each play, you can find some parallel with the Earl of Oxford. It's fascinating, but you can't find any for the Stratford man.
So
certainly nothing in the sonnets.
You certainly have debated the professors more than a couple of times. And when you bring these points up, I just can't understand how they would not be embarrassed in saying, in accepting the possibility that there's very few areas that we've talked about in regards to the Shakespeare as we think of Shakespeare, the Stratfordian person, that this individual was even To me, it almost feels like he was unreal. But you say, and others have said, that he indeed did have a physical body. It really, really was a physical person and not someone that was just made up, correct?
Right. There were two William Shakespeares involved in the theater at the same time. One was a nobleman using a pen name, and the other one was really a theater investor. But also he was a member of an acting company, I will give you that. Mm-hmm. But I believe that the Stratford man's involvement was more as a financier. There's no indication, even though he was a member of an acting company, there's no indication that he actually acted. We don't know any of the roles that he played. And any actual knowledge of him supposedly being an actor is posthumous evidence. It was provided by Ben Jonson the year that the Stratford man had died. So it's tainted evidence.
Well, we have a little tainted evidence right now. We got to move into selling some stuff here on 21st Century Radio. And when we return, let's talk a little bit about the Essex Rebellion and Shakespeare's role and what happened to him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with our guest, Catherine Chilgen. Shakespeare Suppressed, the uncensored truth about Shakespeare and his works. Fair editions, go to ShakespeareSuppressed.com. And again, hopefully a little later on we'll talk about this. You might also like checking out the luminaries who have signed the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt at www.doubtaboutwill.org.
This is Philippa Boyens, one of the screenwriters for The Lord of the Rings. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Catherine Chilgen. Shakespeare Suppressed, the uncensored truth about Shakespeare and his works, fair editions. ShakespeareSuppressed.com. Catherine, the Essex Rebellion. Would you please tell us about Shakespeare's role and what happened to him afterward?
Yes, that's an excellent point. The Essex Rebellion occurred in 1601. The Earl of Essex was trying to take control of the throne of Queen Elizabeth. And the day before the rebellion took place, Essex's supporters paid for a performance of Richard II, which is one of Shakespeare's plays. And in Richard II, the monarch is shown being deposed and successfully deposed. And this, it's believed, was meant to warm up Londoners to the idea of this coming rebellion the next day. Well, the rebellion happened, but it totally fizzled. And the Earl of Essex was captured, and everybody, all of his collaborators, and he was eventually executed. But what about the author of the play? Well, the authorities interrogated the players who performed the plays, but they did not interrogate the author. And this is especially strange because, you know, here we are talking about, you know, really being a traitor.
Yes.
And also, the Earl of Southampton was involved in this rebellion, and he was very closely associated with William Shakespeare. Just a few years before, he was listed on his two poems, Venus and Adonis and Lucrece.
Mm-hmm.
So, by all accounts, I mean, if the Stratford men were the great author, he would have been imprisoned, like the Earl of Southampton and Essex.
Yeah.
And his other supporters. Mm-hmm. But it did not happen, and that's a very strange aspect.
Why do you think it didn't happen?
Well, I think it didn't happen because this was a very old play, mm-hmm. Probably 20 years old, at least. And they know that knew that the author had nothing to do with any rebellion. And it had been the queen already knew about this play. She had seen the play before, and she even associated herself with Richard II. But she allowed it to be performed here and there. But for this particular rebellion, I think it had nothing to do with the great author. They just chose it.
Well, how do we view those plays now? Were they attacks on other noblemen?
No, it was that Shakespeare was just interested in the succession mm-hmm. and revolution. But, you know, he took great license. He criticized other rulers. He criticized Richard III. You know, he portrayed him as a child killer. Another king was poisoned, King John. So he got pretty political, and yet there was no problem from the government. They seemed to be writing, and he seemed to be writing in sync with them, and yet there's no known connection between them.
I'm going to ask you a question about these people: Walt Whitman, Henry James, Mark Twain, Sigmund Freud, Vladimir Nabokov, David McCullough, Charlie Chaplin, Orson Welles, Sir John Gielgud, Michael York, Kenneth Brown. What do they all have in common?
They all doubt that the Stratford man was the great author. And several of them believe he was the Earl of Oxford.
That doesn't move any scholar. I mean, but look at those names. Look at Walt Whitman. I'm getting excited, and I got to slow down here. But you know, when I think of that, Orson Welles, you would never. I don't think this is too well known to most folks, and it's unfortunate because that certainly would have Mark Twain's name there alone, or Henry James. These individuals are men of great artistic, literary, and artistic distinction. I would think that they would know a good deal more about this kind of thing.
Yes. The only people who do not buy this idea are professors of English. They, you know, 95% of them will not accept that there's some reason to doubt the Stratford man. But professors in every other discipline, whether it's linguistics or history or medicine or the law, you name it, you can find doubters. And that's why I'm so glad you brought up the doubtaboutwill.org. You can see that, you know, great mm-hmm. luminaries, very people with very high degrees doubting this. And it's time that the people get full information.
I agree with you because in my opinion, whoever wrote these plays was a genius, a multiple genius. And I'd love to know more about that individual. But what I find very difficult as to why in the world would any a professor, knowing the names of the individuals that I just listed, why and how in the world can they just ignore that? It reminds me of something that I used to when I was a teacher. And I'm sure other people have heard this phrase, and also an artist, that art teachers are those that can teach art but can't do it. And there's a similarity here between the professors who espouse the genius of Shakespeare, but not necessarily focusing on whether that's really credible or not. So I'm gonna be quiet about that now because it bothers me a great deal. It seems to be Catherine. It seems to be a no-brainer here.
Yes. And it's tragic because there are millions of Shakespeare fans. They love him. When they read him, it changes their life. So many actors love Shakespeare. You know. And yet they're being shielded, they're being blocked from mm-hmm. seeing the man and his incredible life story. Mm-hmm. If you just read the Earl of Oxford's life story, I mean, you see it. You see Hamlet. You see everything. Mm-hmm. And they're being denied that. You often when I give talks, the first thing I say is, what do you know about Shakespeare? And most of them are quiet. I mean, you know, they might throw out the word, you know, Romeo and Juliet. But nothing is known about him. There's nothing about his personality that's known. And I believe that they're being robbed.
Well, they are. It's almost like, I hope you don't mind my saying this, but it's almost like today when we can see our weather changing radically. Just look at California. Look at what's going on in the South, and especially to Oklahoma. And people are looking at that and saying, well, this is normal. This is we have these all the time. No, we don't. We don't have number five tornadoes as often as we have had now. We don't always get flooded out. These are serious problems. And yet there are those who basically don't want to hear it, don't want to talk about it, yeah. Doesn't believe it exists. And yet what's going to happen, Catherine, within the next 10 to 15 years, when it becomes so evident that it's too late, it's going to be those people, and I can say exactly who they are. Exxon is certainly supported that there's no problem with weather. You know, it's just you got to rock and roll with it kind of stuff. And the same thing with the what was discovered by the National Cancer Institute, how in the world all of this came about. Well, it just seems to me that we do what they've done to Shakespeare in regards to who really did. It's the same thing right now. We're ignoring a very serious problem that's going to be devastating to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And it won't do any good in 15 years to say, you know, you guys were not only wrong, but you were complicit in this. What are you going to do that? But that's not going to change anything from that standpoint. So
yeah.
I apologize for moving in that direction.
Not at all. But I mean, they are a little bit at fault for, like, if you read these Shakespeare biographies, it's mostly either a history of the period or speculation, because there's so little known about the Stratford man's life, so everything's mm-hmm. filled in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the public needs to know that these
certainly.
Speculative biographies, not real biographies.
Yeah, well, in our case with the weather, we know that Exxon has dumbed us down. We know that they supported anti-global warming. And they don't like it now that they've supported it, but they're caught. They are the people that funded it. Part of the people, you know, there are others, of course. There are other, BP and others did the same kind of thing. But it was all about oil and money. And when I think I mentioned this early on in the introduction. When you look at all of this, why would so many professors seem to think that it's okay to do this? How can they continue to do this? Has money anything to do with it?
I guess there are research grants out there. I think it's just more of they're just kind of maintaining the status quo, and they're not looking at the evidence. You know, I really don't have the answers, you know, why they're turning a blind eye to this. But mm-hmm. that's why I wrote my book, because I wanted the general public to be aware of these issues and to ask them these questions. We need more of the public to call them on the carpet.
Of course.
And
of course.
And but I think you know, the media is internet is really helping.
Boy, am I glad to hear that, because yeah. in other areas of scholarship,
and
it
then,
isn't.
Of course, there was the movie Anonymous that helped.
Oh, I loved
the issue
it
out there.
I had a great time in that movie, and all of my a lot of people when I wrote my critique of it, I would have to tell you, most of my friends thought that was you know, terrible movie. I didn't. I'm so glad that we're beginning to see a little bit of it, even though, I mean, that wasn't necessarily fully a factual movie. But indeed,
right.
indeed, you know, Shakespeare that we've been told about in history or taught about, obviously it was not too well educated that just looking at the handwriting, any handwriting analysis individual, and I know a few of them that would look at that, would tell you some really strange stories about that kind of person who did that. And I don't think they would say, hey, that's got to be William Shakespeare.
Right.
You know, he can't write a sentence?
Well, I think the movie did a good job in depicting the Stratford man.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was an opportunist, I believe. And I think that he may have even come to London because he heard of the name William Shakespeare, and you know, want to see what, you know, if he can profit out of it somehow. But really, he came to London as a moneylender, and there was another theater owner who was also a moneylender back then, and they were associated with each other. So the more you dig into it, the more you see that it was all financial on the Stratford man's part, but nothing having to do with literature or education.
Isn't that strange? Isn't that strange? When we're talking about education and literature and one of the greatest writers
it's
ever.
It's ultimate irony that we're attributing the greatest works of literature in the world to a man who was probably illiterate.
Well, I could say a lot of things about the our today world and that's similar to that in other areas and research, because every area of research has its guardians at the gate as to what is going. And if you cross those folks, you're in deep doo-doo. There are so many important things that have been discovered in geology and archaeology that most people are going to remain ignorant of for quite some time. And I don't know why it takes 20, 30, 40 years for us to catch up to knowledge that was discovered so many decades ago.
But this has been 400 years. It's long enough.
Yes, I think it has been long enough. And we're up against our final break here on 21st Century Radio. And when we return, let's take our focus once again. We're going to take our focus and look a little bit about the a little speculation that who could be the real author? And I know we touched on Edward de Vere, and you've mentioned a few things about him, but this is such an extraordinary soul. At least let us educate our listeners to who could have been responsible for the writing of these works that we call Shakespeare.
Hi, this is Claudette Robinson of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Oh boy, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. Boy, we had a good time with those guys. Now, hey, by the way, Dr. Queen Zahara will be presenting on the future of human experience on June the 10th at 7 p.m. at Breathe Bookstore Cafe, located at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden, sponsored by the Baltimore chapter of the Friends of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Now, this event is open to the public. The Baltimore Friends of the Institute of Noetic Sciences meets every month for vibrant discussions, an engaging book club every other month, plus an occasional field trip. The Baltimore... Yes, it's the Institute of Noetic Sciences. I was just going to say IONS, but, you know, I just want to make sure you know it's the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Follows the work on the nationally based Institute of Noetic Sciences, founded by astronaut our friend Edgar Mitchell, to broaden our knowledge of the nature and potentials of mind and consciousness. Don't miss it. June the 10th, meeting at 7 p.m. for a stimulating discussion by Dr. Queen Zahara Hieronymus, talking about her new book, The Future of Human Experience, Visionary Thinkers on the Science of Consciousness. You can learn more about it at breathebooks.com. That's breathebooks.com. And we're returning to our guest, Catherine Children. Shakespeare Suppressed, The Uncensored Truth About Shakespeare and His Works, Fair Editions. You can acquire it by ShakespeareSuppressed.com. Go there, please, now. All right. Let's see. Gosh. Oh, time is running away. It's running away with us right now. And I just... Let's go to the speculation as to who could have been the real author. We touched on it last hour. We may have mentioned his name not too long ago, but tell us about who you think fits this picture.
Yes, Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford. He was discovered in 1920 or in a book called, I forgot the title now. But anyway, a man named Loney wrote the book and discovered it. But he was... He fit the profile of Shakespeare. And also he was known as a playwright, but we don't have any of his plays in his name.
Mm-hmm.
And a fascinating thing, we come back to Hamlet again. In Hamlet, the character Polonius was actually based on Lord Burleigh, who was the Earl of Oxford's son-in-law. And he, in the play, Lord Polonius gives advice to his son, Laertes. And this advice is a very similar advice that Lord Burleigh gave to his own son, called the Precepts. And this was not published while the Stratford man was alive. So, you know, this how did the great Shakespeare, whoever he was, get that information? How did he know somebody so high up in the government? And it's answered with the Earl of Oxford at every turn.
Well, did the Earl of Oxford know French courtly language? And I know you mentioned various scenes in Italy last hour. Well, not last hour, but about 50 minutes ago.
Yes, he knew their language, of their aristocracy. He knew their customs. He took the grand tour of Europe, so he was very well educated in Europe, and he knew the languages. He knew French. He knew Italian. It's believed he knew some Spanish. You know, so he was a well-rounded, seasoned courtier. And if you look at one of the sonnets, Sonnet 125, he said, "Were it aught to me, I bore the canopy." And what, in other words, he's saying, "Did it mean anything to me that I bore the canopy?" And this could only be a reference to holding a canopy for Queen Elizabeth, a canopy over her, which only courtiers or people of high importance or distinguished people could do. And here he's saying, "Did it mean anything to me that I did that?" Now, if it were the Stratford man, I mean, it would be a high honor. It would be something he would be, you know, so proud of. But here, this is kind of a, you know, a disgruntled courtier in a way talking.
I'm sorry.
And that's straight out of the sonnets, you know.
Does De Vere's timeline fit the publication of Shakespeare's works?
Well, that's it does if you believe that they were written far earlier than the professor will tell you. I have found one of the appendixes to my book is all these unusual word clusters that appear in the plays and that also appear in other people's works, and I have almost 100 of them in the book. And it shows that Shakespeare was writing in the 1570s, 1580s. You know, decades before the professor believes he was writing. So if you take that as your timeline, yeah, it's perfect. It fits with the Earl of Oxford like a glove. He was born in 1550, and he was probably writing at least in the early 1570s and 80s, and probably was finished in the early 1590s, and that is when the professor believes that the Stratford man started writing plays. It's unbelievable.
If De Vere is the author, why do you think he kept it secret?
Yes, well, that's the big why. He says in his sonnets, "My name be buried where my body is." He seemed to know that when he died, the works would not be attributed to him. And in my speculation, in the last two chapters of my book, I think it has to do with the Essex Rebellion. I think that he made a deal with the man in charge back then, behind the Queen, who was Sir Robert Cecil, to allow the release of the Earl of Southampton, who was the fair youth of Shakespeare's sonnet, mm-hmm. very dear to Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I think it could have been along those lines, a quid pro quo. That, he gave something up in return for saving someone's life. It could be that. You know, I don't have definitive proof, but if you read the sonnets, he was certainly aware that he would not get credit after his death for the great Shakespeare works. And when he should have, there would have been no stigma attached to him if his works were published, you know, Hamlet, by the 17th Earl of Oxford. It would have been perfectly fine, but it didn't happen.
Hmm. Wow. Now, let's touch on a little bit before we close out, because this Shakespeare Beyond Doubt, Exposing an Industry in Denial, I am so glad that know this is going on. All of a sudden, and this has been going on for a few years. Can you tell us about it, please?
Yes, I believe it was 2007. They started the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt, and they've had many people from all fields signing on saying it is reasonable to doubt the Stratford man. Mm-hmm. And I believe they have over 2,000 signatures, and they check every single one, you know, to confirm that it is who it is. And it's had great impact, and so much so that the Shakespeare establishment wrote a book saying titled Shakespeare Beyond Doubt, where they try and give the case that the Stratford man was the man. Mm-hmm. And in reply, the same people behind this Declaration of Reasonable Doubt, they wrote their own book, Shakespeare Beyond Doubt, with a question mark. So they give a counter reply. So it's getting heated, and I think it's great. We need the dialogue.
Well,
to get it
is.
Going.
It is great. It really
it's better
is
better than them always ridiculing us.
Well, but this is what happens, when all of the talk about removing into new paradigms and all different fields, but there's such a battle almost. It's like, it kind of reminds me again of politics of, forgive me for this, but the old white men clinging to certain philosophies that are not just outdated or anything, but just wrong as far as I'm concerned, such as in respect of I'll put it this way: the patriarchy, in regards to our planet today. We've been working on a book called Lady Liberty for the last 4.5 years, and hopefully in another year we'll get it done. Focusing on the importance of how women have the capacity, as of course. So many other. What is his? Yeah, I don't know why, but this name has slipped me right now. Who basically said that in 2007 that women are going to change the history of the planet, and the old white men are basically saying no, they're not, and they may have their day for the next 5 or 10 years, but it certainly has altered our planet drastically from where it could be. So therefore, I think that there are some parallels here. But it's in almost every field, Catherine, especially in regards to, say, for instance, the sciences of dealing with even who came to America and when. It used to be thought that, I can't go in that room there. I don't think that's part of what we're talking about right now, but I can't help but think about in every field you have individuals who are basically what would be referred to in the old days as of the old paradigm, who think along certain lines, such as there's no way in the world that anybody in Europe or Africa, say for instance, to get across the Atlantic Ocean when there are ocean currents that you could sit in a bathtub in and that would bring you to the Western world just in several months. It's not a difficult thing to understand, but you can't in academia today, the emphasis is still upon America was really a virgin land, and the Native Americans here weren't doing very much about it, and I think that's a totally wrong view of the Native Americans. Do you have anything to say on that?
Well, I'm hoping you're right. I'm hoping that these old myths are going to get overturned with the truth, and I think the internet is helping. You know, information highway.
Yeah. Well, I want to repeat something that we talked about from the very beginning. Did the Stratford man ever claim authorship?
No, he didn't, and neither did his children or his physician son-in-law or his neighbors or his grandchild. Mm-hmm. So it's really the Shakespeare establishment that is claiming it for him.
Stratford man's last will and testament. What does it reveal about this individual?
It reveals that he was a man of property, basically, and business. And that's it. Mm-hmm. Certainly not a man of literature or the arts.
And again, is it true that, to conclude, that the Stratford man may have been functionally illiterate?
I think it's possible, yes. I mm-hmm. think the evidence suggests it, yes.
I think I'm more biased than you are.
You know, it's not the Stratford man's fault. I mean,
of course not. Right.
This was foisted upon him mm-hmm. years after he died, and the same with the Earl of Oxford. I don't think either of them would have believed what happened. Mm-hmm. And it was the mischief created from the first folio of 1623 in the opening pages. And I just want to throw in 1640, some anonymous writer printed this phrase, "Shakespeare, we must be silent in thy praise."
Oh, yes.
A generation.
Yes. Yeah.
After they had both died.
Well, Catherine,
why should we be silent? And I just want to leave that with your listeners.
Well, obviously, I don't think we should ever be silent about that type of thing. But you know, I'm biased. I may be still a white old man, though, you know. I'm 70 years old now, and I can understand what they're talking about. Catherine, I want to thank you for joining us on 21st Century Radio.
Pleasure.
It was a real thrill. It really was. You know, I'm just so glad that you followed through. I'm so glad that you've done so many things in challenging the professors. They need to wake up eventually. And I hope it's sooner than later, obviously, because the Shakespeare was an extraordinary soul. The person that we think was Shakespeare was. See you next week on 21st Century Radio with, actually, Dr. Queen Zahara will be with you.
You gotta spread the word. Tell them what you heard. We're gonna make a better day.
Stimulating talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com. Fox News Radio 1.